For many, the image of an eating disorder is one that rarely includes men. But for Conor Nolan, the reality began at just 11 years old. What started as an obsession with fitness and football quickly spiraled into a silent passenger, anorexia, that would shape the next decade of his life. In this bonus episode of the Greg Hughes podcast, I'm joined by Conor, the author of Normal, to discuss his incredibly raw and honest journey through recovery. We dive into the unique challenges men face, the damaging public perception of gender when it comes to mental health, and how he transformed his struggle into a mission, from a teenager battling a monkey in his head to a man now pursuing a PhD in the psychology of eating disorders. Conor's story is a powerful reminder that vulnerability is a strength and that recovery is not just possible, it's transformative. Do you think, to some extent, we're breaking a notion listeners might have talking about eating disorders, talking to a male?
100%, yeah, because I suppose one thing is very important to know, like eating disorders are more common in females, there's no doubt about that. But they're definitely more common in males than people realise. I think roughly, like in the case of, let's say, anorexia, you know, one in four cases occur in a male. And then with something like, let's say, binge eating disorder, it occurs in males and females 50-50. So absolutely, there's definitely the frequency of occurrence in males versus the perceived occurrence is definitely very different. So yeah, I think we're getting there in terms of educating people and as you say, yeah, breaking the mold there and changing that perception.
Yeah, exactly, because, you know, fellas, if I could put it like that, they might associate it with something else or say something else because they don't feel this is something that could affect a boy, or this is something I could speak about or get help about, and it could manifest itself in different ways. That's why it's important to talk, isn't it?
100%, yeah. The problem there, you know, like if someone is in the frame of mind that, oh, this couldn't possibly happen to me, well, then they're not going to look out for certain warning signs, or even worse so, if the warning signs do come along, they will ignore them and think, oh, well, no, this must be something different, or this mustn't be too serious at all. So yeah, definitely understanding that it can, as we often say, you know, eating disorders don't discriminate. They can affect anyone, any gender, any age or any stage in life. Very, very much so. Yes.
The age 11, 12, very important to you as part of, you know, this story of yours, this experience of yours. When do you believe, you know, this actually began?
So that's a great question. I would have, I suppose in my case, you know, I would have been diagnosed when I was 12, you know, turning 13. But like, you know, at that stage, it's very much, it's in full flow. You know, in my case with anorexia involves a lot of weight loss. Again, every eating disorder, there are multiple eating disorders and each one's of different characteristics. But, you know, by the time I was diagnosed, I had lost an awful lot of weight. The behaviours that led to that weight loss were in place long before that. And then even before the anorexic tendencies really began to kick in, there was little sort of things that I can see in hindsight that were very much leading towards the eating disorder. So I would say, you know, maybe from the age of 10 onwards, the cogs were starting to move. The way I look at it is I was a very keen young athlete. I was a very, you know, keen footballer and all that kind of stuff. And I would have trained hard for the purpose of, you know, getting better on the pitch. And then slowly but surely, the focus started to move away from the on-pitch performance and more towards things like, you know, the weighing scales and the food and looking in the mirror and so on. So I'd say going back as far as maybe the age of 10, things were starting to go on the turn a bit, 100%.
So then the sport and activity we're involved in, is, yeah, would this have manifested itself if you hadn't been involved in sport, or are you of the view that it would have found its way to the surface one way or other?
Well, it's a great question. And I suppose one thing, a lot of, you know, in a lot of cases, people who develop an eating disorder, you know, may be athletes. And, you know, with some eating disorders, there is that element that over-exercise or exercising quite strenuously is one of the components. Now, one thing that's interesting, like, especially given the age that I developed this at, a very common thing with an eating disorder is that a period of change can very much cause havoc. So, you know, at the age of 11, 12, 13, you have that that transition from primary into secondary school. And that can very much like trigger an eating disorder into full bloom, because there's a huge element with an eating disorder of control. And when there's a feeling of a loss of control in someone's life, they can sort of try and refine this control with their food and with their exercise as kind of a coping mechanism. The question of whether it would have happened, excuse me, if I hadn't been playing a sport is a good question. Personally, I think, you know, if it was going to play out, it probably would have found a way to do so. The way I look at it is, because I had a love for sport and a love for training and that kind of stuff, the eating disorder had, it had something to take and then, I suppose you can already say in some case, kind of like turn against me. But, you know, definitely there are cases where people develop an eating disorder, you know, and they mightn't be athletes at all. So it's I'm not exactly sure. I think it might have played out regardless. I think so.
So if you could just maybe help us, if you can, to get inside the mind of 11, 12, 13-year-old. So if you're very active, you know, the perception would be from others that you're in good shape, right? That you're toned, yeah, or you're lean or your body mass index is low. You obviously don't feel that way in yourself. So when you look into the mirror, if you did, and whether that's literally or metaphorically, what do you see? Is it a comparison to others? Is it quite literally, you know, you see something that others don't see? Just so we maybe can tap into what might be going on in houses that might help, if you get where I'm coming from.
100%, yeah. So one of the, I suppose, components, you know, when you think about the case of anorexia, there's a term called body dysmorphia. So body dysmorphia is when someone has a sort of a very negative perception of their appearance. They're very much caught in this idea of, you know, they're unhappy with the way they look, and that feeling can cause them to almost go out of their way to find flaws, right? And now when I say flaws, I would say flaws in like inverted commas, flaws that might as well be unnoticeable to the naked eye of the observer. And this sort of nitpicking approach is coming along due to the thoughts and feelings underneath. And so so what can happen in the case of anorexia is someone, they very much cannot see their body clearly. They're not seeing themselves through an accurate lens. It's kind of like a broken lens in some case. So I always give the example of with anorexia, for example, if someone is beginning to lose weight, you know, they've lost a noticeable amount of weight, friends or family might communicate that or might voice their concerns. And the person with anorexia, and as I did in my case, they might deny that there's a problem. Partially because, number one, they see the eating disorder as a coping mechanism, but also number two, because they, when they look in the mirror, they don't see themselves as being any smaller than they were before. And that was definitely the case in my case. Like when I look back, like now as I'm recovered, when I look back at photos of myself from when I was at my lowest weight, I can see that I was terribly underweight, very low BMI. I think emaciated would be the medical term. But when I was in that moment, you know, literally, when I looked in the mirror, I wasn't seeing that. You know, I wouldn't say I saw myself as being overweight, but I definitely saw myself as being a lot bigger than I actually was. So yes, there is that kind of flawed perception, and that can feed into this thing of, oh well, I'm not seeing what everyone else is seeing, so it mustn't be true. So I have to keep going. I have to keep restricting. I have to keep losing weight. So 100%, a big part of the recovery is repairing that perception of your body image. You know, it's beginning to see yourself clearly. And then, like in my case, you know, becoming okay with the fact that you have to regain the weight for the sake of your health. And one thing I find particularly notable is, like, I was in counselling for a year in this recovery process, and how I looked at myself in the mirror, you know, at the start of that year, at the end, was night and day. You know, to be able to regain the weight and look in the mirror and be happy and not be, I suppose, not be judging yourself the way you were before. So yeah, absolutely, it's very much a distorted view that you have of oneself, 100%.
Were you good at hiding it? Were you good at, or did you attempt to hide it from those in the house? You know, I've spoken to others in the past that will pocket food, you know, go to extreme lengths to try and mask what's going on. Maybe it's difficult at the age you were. It depends on the type of child you were too, of course. But what was that like? Was it clear there was an issue, or were you good at hiding it? Did you try and hide it? Did you understand what, you know, you were really trying to achieve?
Yeah. That's a great question. I think what helped me in terms of I don't think I consciously hid it, but definitely what helped the eating disorder play out was, I've always been very, very good with numbers. Even as a child, I would have been quite good at maths, and so I had the ability to, I suppose you could say, count calories in my head without anybody noticing. You know, I could do the mental arithmetic very, very quickly. So you know, I could kind of work out, you know, you end up in this position where you think, okay, well, I have to eat less than yesterday. I have to move more than yesterday. And so, you know, you're not breaking out a pen and paper and a calculator. You're doing the sort of mental arithmetic on the fly. So that was one of the things, I suppose, that helped me keep what I was doing under the radar in some sense. But in terms of hiding, I suppose there is the some of the noticeable things are, you know, you begin to have this, or one element is you begin to have a fear of, let's say, clearing your plate. You know, you start to leave more and more food behind you because you're trying to, or the eating disorder is causing you to try and eat less and less as time goes on. So definitely as you get further into it, it becomes harder and harder to hide, number one, from a physical perspective, because the weight loss in my case was definitely noticeable, and also the fact that the amount you're eating is now becoming, you know, so minimal. But I think, yeah, purely at the start, what helped me mask my behaviors was having an eye for detail and having a good head for numbers, where I could, you know, as I could count these things in my head, kind of thing. But that's kind of the main hiding that went on, you could say.
I would say a lot of these interviews you do, the interviewer will eventually start talking about, you know, social media and the pressures and this, that, and that. And I'm not discrediting that, but at the end of the day, this sounds almost like it is separate from that. That maybe if we over focused on that, we're missing what might actually be going on. Because you know, your triggers were different, and maybe someone else's triggers would be social media. But you know, what do we need to be looking at to try and, I suppose, is it about putting less pressure on young people to have a certain image? Because there's a lot of sort of body positivity that's negative, really, in terms of people being too heavy as well, too, right? This is a sweet spot, I suppose, but what do you think?
Well, this very much feeds into the point of, you know, what we ask the question of what causes an eating disorder. And that is, it's a great question to ask, but I suppose one of the problems is it's a very open-ended question. So whether it's anorexia, whether it's bulimia, no matter what eating disorder it is, there are a vast number of causes. And, you know, there are some common causes across the board, but every case can be different. So when I look back in my case, negative body image, or sort of a flawed perception of one's own body, was definitely part of the trigger in my case. In other cases, it can be low self-esteem. So that kind of the feeling of the person's not good enough in themselves. Excuse me, they're not, you know, something is missing. Bullying can be another sort of triggering thing. In some people's cases, it can be grief, it can be loss, different things like this. When you mentioned the social media thing there, that is definitely a factor. So what I suppose the biggest thing there is, you know, when young people are seeing unrealistic portrayals of, you know, this is what the human body looks like. So you have your filtered photos and, you know, the sort of Photoshopper and all this kind of stuff. And then, like, you know, like with the fitness culture, which again, there are many, many good sides to it. I suppose one of the negatives from the fitness culture is people are, you know, posting photos that are in extremely perfect lighting, or, you know, in extremely perfect conditions, expensive cameras and so on. And I mean, look, people have every right to.
But just in relation to that, Conor, not to cut across you, I don't really know anyone that doesn't try and portray the best of themselves on socials or use social media. So to some extent, I think there's a, you know, there's an acute self-awareness or body consciousness. It's just about degrees, if you know what I mean. I think perhaps, you know, I mean, it's a very complex situation, but it's not just about, you know, trying to achieve what you see in social media either. I think it's more complex is really what I'm trying to get at. I think sometimes we have the late, not you and I, but I think sometimes we have the lazy conversation that say, oh, it's social media, right? But for your triggers, were maybe the locker room or on the track or whatever it might be. It's, you say it's very complex.
100%, yeah, exactly. So as you say there, yeah, there's the as you say, the people around us and peer pressure can have a massive impact as well. So the key thing with an eating disorder to keep in mind, and the funny thing is, the term eating disorder can almost be misleading in itself, because the issues with eating, or the issues with body image and the issues with weight, let's say, are very much the, of course they are a problem, but the way I look at it, definitely in my own case, it's symptoms. They are the symptoms of what's really going on underneath. What's driving an eating disorder is the emotional difficulties, and therefore these behaviors, whether it's restricting food intake or overexercising, they are a way of sort of coping with the feelings underneath. So those feelings, as you say, could be coming from the locker room pressure, the peer pressure, as I mentioned, coming from other traumas like grief or loss or whatever it is. So you're 100% right. It's a very, very complex thing. And in the recovery process, in counseling or whatever avenue someone goes down, that process very much focuses on addressing those thoughts, those feelings, those traumas, or whatever it is, because that is the root of the eating disorder.
Yeah.
You know, you do have the work. Like, I remember myself doing a lot of work in counselling on body image. So my counsellor was, you know, getting me to stand in front of the mirror. She was helping me to see that, you know, the mirror can almost play tricks on us when we're in a bad position in terms of our body image and how we perceive ourselves. So there is that little bit of work as well. But a lot of it really goes down to the roots, you know, the emotional roots underneath the whole thing. That's what's driving it on.
Can I ask, if you don't mind, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, were you an anxious child? Would you have had knots in your stomach going to bed, that kind of stuff? Or did this come on just sort of when you went into double digits?
Yeah, not at all. Like, I would have been a very bubbly, chatty child. You know, What's funny is, like, I'm 27, I have a brother who's 9, and my mother often tells me that myself and him are, you know, we're like carbon copies of each other. And he's a very bubbly, energetic, you know, funny child as well, you know, very witty and so on. So according to family, like, I would have been very like that. And you're right, I suppose it would have been a change that came along around the age of 10 or 11. So definitely in early childhood, in my case, there was no early warning signs. Again, every case can be different.
Right, you've written a book called, you've written a book, and it's how you sort of want to tell your story. So explain it to me, because the book's called Normal, as I mentioned a little earlier on, right? But it's not like an autobiography or what have you. So just explain it to the listeners to how you tell the story.
100%, yes. So the key thing I wanted to do when I was writing this was, so there is, I suppose, an autobiographical element of telling, you know, what I've experienced. But I wanted to deliver it in such a way where it was very much addressing certain issues head on. So some of the issues were, you know, the stigma around mental health, stigma around counselling. One of the things I experienced as well was sort of in rural Ireland in particular, how it can be very difficult to be dealing with something like this because you're worried about, are people talking about you, or is word going around the town, that kind of stuff. But the way I get the story across, I wanted to, when I was writing the book, I wanted to highlight and emphasize how important conversation is. So the entire book is written as a conversation between myself and, there's a character who I call the stranger, who I'm sitting talking to. He's almost like an amateur counselor type of character. And I often say, if the book was to be a play or be something on screen, I would request, from a directorial point of view, let's say, that the audience would never see the stranger's face. And the reason for that, I wanted to sort of promote this idea that help can come from anywhere. The listening ear can come from anywhere. So in the story, I've just met this person and we're having this very, very in-depth conversation at kind of a social gathering kind of thing. So it's very much like a back and forth between myself and this person, and I'm taking him through my life experiences and then the lessons I learned from that, which I believe could help others.
Sounds like my inner dialogue. It's an interesting interesting approach, me and him tease an awful lot of stuff out. Right, okay, so do you frame again, I don't want to group all eating disorders in together, because it's really just not like that, but I mean, from your perspective, actually, that's the easiest way. Are you anorexic your entire life and this is something you have to check, keep a check on, or are you better now, or how do you phrase it, or what?
It's a fantastic question. So the way I would say I'm recovered, but I avoid saying, now the reason I say recovered is because I'm at a stage where, you know, I'm at a healthy body weight. Physically, I'm in the full of my health. I have a very good relationship now with my body image. I have a very good relationship with food. I think the term is food freedom. Food freedom meaning that you can eat without thinking about it. You can go to your favorite restaurant and not think twice, all that kind of stuff. I would say I'm very much at that stage. The reason why I wouldn't use a word like cured, excuse me, is because with every eating disorder, because again, there are different eating disorders, but there's common features across the board. And one of the common features is, you know, you can relapse. So in the same way that an eating disorder can happen to anyone that has had it, even if they've gone through the counseling process or they've made amends, they could relapse. You know, a difficult period in life could come along. So one thing I've noticed is, so I mentioned earlier on there that when this all started, I was going through that transition from primary to secondary school. I realized then later in life, like when I finished secondary school and when I finished college, I had similar problems, not from a food or body weight standpoint, but I had a lot of anxiety. And when I look back in hindsight, and I've been able to work through this with a counselor, I can see a lot of similarities in my thought patterns and the anxiety I was feeling at 13, 19, and 23.
Yeah.
Now, again, many would argue, oh, because I never lost weight again, well, that means I'm recovered. But I know from my own experience that the thought patterns and the anxieties were reoccurring. So I would say I'm recovered, but I do think it's something you have to be vigilant of. Mm. And I often phrase it as, you know, it's something you learn to live with, and you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, listen, the thing about it is in this space, we've so much more to do, but we've never talked more about it. You know, we've never maybe had the space in secondary schools where you can, you know, reach out for help or a conversation if you need to be. And it's a little bit like self-harm. It's a little bit about like anxiety and depression. We're talking about it more. There's more supports than ever. Awful lot to do. But we're actually seeing an increase in these instances. And it's the same with eating disorders. We need to figure out what's actually happening, don't we? Because from my perspective, I find a lot of the messaging for you to do the right thing is negative. You're going to get diabetes, you're going to die, your bones are going to be damaged, you know. And for someone like me, who's quite an anxious person and an overthinker, that doesn't help me go to the gym or get out walking or what have you. It always seemed to be framed in sort of negativity. And I think the people you might be wanting to reach the most are not really receptive to that in a positive way, if that makes sense.
No, 100%, you're right. There's a balance there in how we approach the message. I think like the one thing the way I look at it is like when I was diagnosed with anorexia, that was in 2011. So that's what, so 15 years ago now. And like I do a lot of work with Bodywise now, and I give talks in schools around the country. And you know, I often think like, well, it would have been extremely helpful for me to have, with say, one of the kind of talks I give now when I was in that position, primarily just from an educational standpoint and being, I suppose, more aware of what's going on. I always give the analogy of, you know, if you go to the doctor and you say, what's wrong? Let's say you have the symptoms of asthma, and the doctor goes, oh yes, that's asthma, we'll give you an inhaler. But if you were to go to a doctor with symptoms of some kind and the doctor said, oh, I've never seen this before, you'd start to panic, because if we don't know what we're dealing with, it's sort of the fear of the unknown. So one of the things I find is really good now is that because there is more messaging and awareness out there, we are becoming more knowledgeable about these things across the board. And so I suppose the average person, even if they are only kind of passively taking in the message about mental health, they are maybe a bit more aware to look out for and all that kind of stuff. But you are right that there is certain forms of the messaging that aren't helpful. As you say, it can do more harm than good. And I think one of the things that's important in the messaging around eating disorders is that recovery is possible. And again, I hear on the phone as living proof of it, that recovery is possible.
And with help and the right support, it's probable.
Yes.
Not just possible, it's very achievable. Connor, is it available now? How do people get their hands on it?
Amazon is the best way to get a hold of that. It's available worldwide. Yeah.
Brilliant. It's great for you. It's a great way to distribute it, isn't it? It's so simple. And Bodywise as well. Do you want to signpost that organization just for anyone who's listening? And I think with our audience, the reality is, Connor, though it's not age exclusive, but certainly in terms of relating to you, I think parents are going to, it's going to put certain things, levels of awareness, you know what I mean? They might need to seek some support, yeah, maybe to support someone in their home. So is Bodywise a good spot for that?
Absolutely. And the thing about, so with the Bodywise website, first of all, you have the information about the different eating disorders, what they all entail. But more importantly, there's the helplines that are available. There's different support services there. And again, it's not just for, we'll say, the person like myself who may have been experiencing an eating disorder. It's also for the friends and family, because the reality of an eating disorder has a blast radius in some sense. It doesn't just affect the person. It's tough for families and friends as well. So families can get support. So there's a thing called the Pillar Program in Bodywise. That's a free program for parents to learn more about the eating disorders and what's going on. And likewise, you know, friends or siblings can get in touch with some of the helplines as well to get support for themselves and to learn more about how they can be there for the person in their life that is struggling. So there's supports there for the individual and for those around, 100%. All right. And those are all 100% free and confidential.
Brilliant. Connor Nolan, glad to hear things are going well for you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
A big thank you to Connor once again, and thank you too, by the way, for listening to the Greg Hughes podcast. That was a bonus episode. We release regular episodes every Friday morning at 11 a.m. and we love your feedback. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can contact its researcher and producer, Caroline Orr, at carolineorr@highlandradio.com. But look after yourself until we chat again.